Inside 25, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 933. Then she touched down and was running. This dream, whatever it was, moved fast. She ran after it, pursuing sleep, silence, maybe just time. The years moved fast. The years ran. If you turned around and ran after your own childhood, you had to really let out your stride and bust your buns. 29, the year she had streaked her hair. Faster. 22, the year she had fallen in love with a football player named Greg Mallory, who had damn near raped her after a fraternity party. Faster, faster. 16, getting drunk with two of her girlfriends on the Bluebird Hill Overlook in Portland. 14, 12, faster, faster, faster. She ran into sleep, chasing 12, catching it, running through the barrier of memory that it had cast over all of them. It tasted like cold fog in her laboring dream lungs. Running back into her 11th year, running, running like hell, running to beat the devil. Looking back now, looking back. 6. The Barrens, 12:40 p.m. Over her shoulder for any sign of them as she slipped and scrambled her way down the embankment. No sign, at least not yet. She had really fetched it to him, as her father sometimes said, and just thinking of her father brought another wave of guilt and despondency washing over her. She looked under the rickety bridge, hoping to see Silver heeled over on his side, but Silver was gone. There was a cache of toy guns which they no longer bothered to take home, and that was all. She started down the path, looked back. And there they were, Belch and Victor supporting Henry between them, standing on the edge of the embankment like Indian sentries in a Randolph Scott movie. Henry was horribly pale. He pointed at her. Victor and Belch began to help him down the slope. Dirt and gravel spilled from beneath their heels. Beverly looked at them for a long moment, almost hypnotized. Then she turned and sprinted through the trickle of brook water that ran out from under the bridge, ignoring Ben's stepping stones, her sneakers spraying out flat sheets of water. She ran down the path, the breath hot in her throat. She could feel the muscles in her legs trembling. She didn't have much left now. The clubhouse. If she could get there, she might still be safe. She ran along the path, branches whipping even more color into her cheeks, one striking her eye and making it water. She cut to the right, blundered through tangles of underbrush, and came out into the clearing. Both the camouflage trap door and the slit window stood open. Rock and roll drifted up. At the sound of her approach, Ben Hanscom popped up. He had a box of Junior Mints in one hand and an Archie comic book in the other. He got a good look at Bev and his mouth fell open. Under other circumstances, it would have been almost funny. "Bev, what the hell?" She didn't bother replying. Behind her, and not too far behind either, she could hear branches snapping and whipping. There was a muffled, shouted curse. It sounded as if Henry was getting livelier. So she just ran at the square trap door opening, her hair tangled now with green leaves and twigs as well as the crud from her scramble under the garbage truck, streaming out behind her. Ben saw she was coming in like the 101st Airborne and disappeared as quickly as he had come out. Beverly jumped and he caught her clumsily. "Shut everything," she panted. "Hurry up, Ben. For heaven's sake, they're coming." "Who?" "Henry and his friends. Henry's gone crazy. He's got a knife." That was enough for Ben. He dropped his Junior Mints and funny book. He pulled the trap door shut with a grunt. The top was covered with sods. The tangle track was still holding them remarkably well. A few blocks of sod had gotten loose, but that was all. Beverly stood on tiptoe and closed the window. They were in darkness. She felt for Ben, found him, and hugged him with panicky tightness. After a moment, he hugged her back. They were both on their knees. With sudden horror, Beverly realized that Richie's transistor radio was still playing somewhere in the blackness. Little Richard singing, "The Girl Can't Help It."
"Ben, the radio, they'll hear..."
"Oh, God." He butted her with one meaty hip and almost knocked her sprawling in the dark. She heard the radio fall to the floor. "The girl can't help it if the men folks stop and stare," Little Richard informed them with his customary hoarse enthusiasm.
"Can't help it," the backup group testified. "The girl can't help it."
Ben was panting now, too. They sounded like a couple of steam engines. Suddenly, there was a crunch and silence.
"Oh, shit," Ben said. "I just squashed it. Richie's gonna have a bird."
He reached for her in the dark. She felt his hand touch one of her breasts, then jerk away as if burned. She groped for him, got hold of his shirt, and drew him close.
"Beverly, what?"
"Shh." He quieted. They sat together, arms around each other, looking up.
The darkness was not quite perfect. There was a narrow line of light down one side of the trap door, and three others outlined the slit window. One of these three was wide enough to let a slanted ray of sunlight fall into the clubhouse. She could only pray they wouldn't see it. She could hear them approaching. At first she couldn't make out the words, and then she could. Her grip on Ben tightened. "If she went into the bamboo, we can pick up her trail easy," Victor was saying. "They play around here," Henry replied. His voice was strained, his words emerging in little puffs, as if with great effort. "Boogers Taliendo said so. And the day we had that rock fight, they were coming from here." "Yeah, they play guns and stuff," Belt said. Suddenly there were thudding footfalls right above them. The sod-covered cap vibrated up and down. Dirt sifted onto Beverly's upturned face. One, two, maybe even all three of them were standing on top of the clubhouse. A cramp laced her belly. She had to bite down against a cry. Ben put one big hand on the side of her face and pressed it against his arm as he looked up, waiting to see if they would guess, or if they knew already and were just playing games. "They got a place," Henry was saying. "That's what Boogers told me. Some kind of a treehouse or something. They call it their club." "I'll club 'em if they want a club," Victor said. Belch uttered a thunderous hee-haw of laughter at this. Thump, thump, thump overhead. The cap moved up and down a little more this time. Surely they would notice it. Ordinary ground just didn't have that kind of give. "Let's look down by the river," Henry said. "I bet she's down there." "Okay," Victor said. Thump, thump. They were moving off. Bev let a little sigh of relief trickle through her clamped teeth. And then Henry said, "You stay here and guard the path, Belch." "Okay," Belch said, and he began to march back and forth, sometimes leaving the cap, sometimes coming back across it. More dirt sifted down. Ben and Beverly looked at each other with strained, dirty faces. Bev became aware that there was more than the smell of smoke in the clubhouse. A sweaty, garbagey stink was rising as well. "That's me," she thought dismally. In spite of the smell, she hugged Ben even tighter. His bulk seemed suddenly very welcome, very comforting, and she was glad there was a lot of him to hug. He might have been nothing but a frightened fat boy when school let out for the summer, but he was more than that now. Like all of them, he had changed. If Belch discovered them down here, Ben just might give him a surprise. "I'll club 'em if they want a club," Belch said and chuckled. A Belch Huggins chuckle was a low, troll-like sound. "Club 'em if they want a club. That's good. That's pretty much okie-dokie." She became aware that Ben's upper body was heaving up and down in short, sharp movements. He was pulling air into his lungs and letting it out in little bursts. For one alarmed moment, she thought he was starting to cry. And then she got a closer look at his face and realized he was struggling against laughter. His eyes, leaking tears, caught hers, rolled madly and looked away. In the faint light which struggled in through the cracks around the closed trap door and the window, she could see his face was nearly purple with the strain of holding it in. "Club 'em if they want an old clubby-dubby," Belch said, and sat down heavily right in the center of the cap. This time the roof trembled more alarmingly, and Bev heard a low but ominous crack from one of the supports. The cap had been meant to support the chunks of camouflaging sod laid on top of it, but not the added 160 pounds of Belch Huggins's weight. "If he doesn't get up, he's going to land in our laps," Bev thought, and she began to catch Ben's hysteria. It was trying to boil out of her in rancid whoops and brays. In her mind's eye, she suddenly saw herself pushing the window up enough on its hinges for her hand to creep out and administer a really good goose to Belch Huggins's backside as he sat there in the hazy afternoon sunshine, muttering and giggling. She buried her face against Ben's chest in a last-ditch effort to keep it inside. "Shh," Ben whispered. "For Christ's sake, Bev." Crack, louder this time. "Will it hold?" she whispered back. "It might if he doesn't fart," Ben said. And a moment later, Belch did cut one, a loud and fruity trumpet blast that seemed to go on for at least 3 seconds. They held each other even tighter, muffling each other's frantic giggles. Beverly's head hurt so badly that she thought she might soon have a stroke. Then, faintly, she heard Henry yelling Belch's name. "What?" Belch bellowed, getting up with a thump and a thud that sifted more dirt down on Ben and Beverly. "What, Henry?" Henry yelled something back. Beverly could only make out the words bank and bushes. "Okay," Belch bawled, and his feet crossed the cap for the last time. There was a final cracking noise, this one much louder, and a splinter of wood landed in Bev's lap. She picked it up wonderingly.
5 more minutes, Ben said in a low whisper. That's all it would have taken.
Did you hear him when he let go? Beverly asked, beginning to giggle again.
Sounded like World War III,
Ben said, also beginning to laugh. It was a relief to be able to let it out, and they laughed wildly, trying to do it in whispers. Finally, unaware she was going to say it at all, and certainly not because it had any discernible bearing on this situation, Beverly said,
"Thank you for the poem, Ben."
Ben stopped laughing all at once and regarded her gravely, cautiously. He took out a dirty handkerchief from his back pocket and wiped his face with it slowly.
"Poem?"
"The haiku. The haiku on the postcard. You sent it, didn't you?"
"No," Ben said. "I didn't send you any haiku. 'Cause if a kid like me, a fat kid like me, did something like that, the girl would probably laugh at him."
"I didn't laugh. I thought it was beautiful."
"I could never write anything beautiful. Bill maybe, not me."
"Bill will write," she agreed. "But he'll never write anything as nice as that. May I use your handkerchief?" He gave it to her, and she began to clean her face as best she could.
"How did you know it was me?" he asked finally.
"I don't know," she said. "I just did." Ben's throat worked convulsively. He looked down at his hands.
"I didn't mean anything by it."
She looked at him gravely.
"You better not mean that," she said. "If you do, it's really going to spoil my day. And I'll tell you, it's going downhill already."
He continued to look down at his hands and spoke at last in a voice she could barely hear.
"Well, I mean I love you, Beverly, but I don't want that to spoil anything."
"It won't," she said, and hugged him. "I need all the love I can get right now."
"But you specially like Bill."
"Maybe I do," she said, "but that doesn't matter. If we were grown-ups, maybe it would, a little. But I like you all specially. You're the only friends I have."
"I love you too, Ben."
"Thank you," he said. He paused, trying, and brought it out. He was even able to look at her as he said it. "I wrote the poem." They sat without saying anything for a little while. Beverly felt safe, protected. The images of her father's face and Henry's knife seemed less vivid and threatening when they sat close like this. That sense of protection was hard to define, and she didn't try, although much later she would recognize the source of its strength. She was in the arms of a male who would die for her with no hesitation at all. It was a fact that she simply knew. It was in the scent that came from his pores, something utterly primitive that her own glands could respond to.
"The others were coming back," Ben said suddenly. "What if they get caught out?"
She straightened up, aware that she had almost been dozing. Bill, she remembered, had invited Mike Hanlon home to lunch with him. Richie was going to go home with Stan and have sandwiches. And Eddie had promised to bring back his Parcheesi board. They would be arriving soon, totally unaware that Henry and his friends were in the Barrens.
"We've got to get to them," Beverly said. "Henry's not just after me."
"If we come out and they come back..."
"Yes, but at least we know they're here. Bill and the other guys don't. Eddie can't even run. They already broke his arm."
"Jeezum crow," Ben said. "I guess we'll have to chance it."
"Yeah."
She swallowed and looked at her Timex. It was hard to read in the dimness, but she thought it was a little past one.
"Ben."
"What?"
"Henry's really gone crazy. He's like that kid in the blackboard jungle. He was going to kill me, and the other two were going to help him."
"Ah, no," Ben said. "Henry's crazy, but not that crazy. He's just..."
"Just what?" Beverly said.
She thought of Henry and Patrick in the automobile graveyard in the thick sunshine. Henry's blank eyes. Ben didn't answer. He was thinking. Things had changed, hadn't they? When you were inside the changes, they were harder to see. You had to step back to see them. You had to try, anyway. When school let out, he'd been afraid of Henry, but only because Henry was bigger, and because he was a bully, the kind of kid who would grab a first grader, Indian rub his arm, and send him away crying. That was about all. Then he had engraved Ben's belly. Then there had been the rock fight, and Henry had been chucking M-80s at people's heads. You could kill somebody with one of those things. You could kill somebody easy. He had started to look different. Haunted, almost. It seemed that you always had to be on watch for him, the way you'd always have to be on watch for tigers or poisonous snakes if you were in the jungle. But you got used to it. so used to it that it didn't even seem unusual, just the way things were. But Henry was crazy, wasn't he? Yes. Ben had known that on the day school ended, and had willfully refused to believe it or remember it. It wasn't the kind of thing you wanted to believe or remember. And suddenly a thought so strong it was almost a certainty, crept into his mind full-blown, as cold as October mud. It's using Henry. Maybe the others, too. But it's using them through Henry. And if that's the truth, then she's probably right. It's not just Indian rubs or rabbit punches in the back of the neck during study time, near the end of the school day while Mrs. Douglas reads her book at her desk. Not just a push in the playground so that you fall down and skin your knee. If it's using him, then Henry will use the knife. An old lady saw them trying to beat me up, Beverly was saying. Henry went after her. He kicked her taillight out. This alarmed Ben more than anything else. He understood instinctively, as most kids did, that they lived below the sight lines, and hence the thought lines, of most adults. When a grown-up was diddy-bopping down the street, thinking his grown-up thoughts about work and appointments and buying cars and whatever else grown-ups thought about, he never noticed kids playing hopscotch or guns or kick the can or ring-a-leave-o or hide-and-go-seek. Bullies like Henry could get away with hurting other kids quite a lot if they were careful to stay below that sight line. At the very most, a passing adult was apt to say something like, "Why don't you quit that?" and then just continue diddy-bopping along without waiting to see if the bully stopped or not. So the bully would wait until the grown-up had turned the corner, and then go back to business as usual. It was like adults thought that real life only started when a person was 5 feet tall. If Henry had gone after some old lady, he had gone above that sight line, and that more than anything else suggested to Ben that he really was crazy. Beverly saw the belief in Ben's face and felt relief sweep over her. She would not have to tell him about how Mr. Ross had simply folded his paper and walked into his house. She didn't want to tell him about that. It was too scary. "Let's go up to Kansas Street," Ben said, and abruptly pushed open the trap door. "Get ready to run." He stood up in the opening and looked around. The clearing was silent. He could hear the chuckling voice of the Kandusky close by, birdsong, the thumb-thud of a diesel engine snorting its way into the train yards. He heard nothing else, and that made him uneasy. He would have felt much better if he'd heard Henry, Victor, and Belch cursing their way through the heavy undergrowth down by the stream. But he couldn't hear them at all. "Come on," he said, and helped Beverly up. She also looked around uneasily, brushing her hair back with her hands and grimacing at its greasy feel. He took her hand and they pushed through a screen of bushes toward Kansas Street. "We'd better stay off the path." "No," she said. "We've got to hurry." He nodded. "All right." They got to the path and started toward Kansas Street. Once she stumbled over a rock in the path and... 7. The seminary grounds, 2:17 a.m. fell heavily on the moon-silvered sidewalk. A grunt was forced out of him, and a runner of blood came with the grunt, splatting onto the cracked concrete. In the moonlight, it looked as black as beetle blood. Henry looked at it for a long, dazed moment, then raised his head to look around. Kansas Street was early morning silent, the houses shut up and dark except for a scatter of nightlights. Ah, here was a sewer grate. A balloon with a smiley smile face was tied to one of its iron bars. The balloon bobbed and dipped in the faint breeze. Henry got to his feet again, one sticky hand pressed to his belly. The nigger had stuck him pretty good, but Henry had gone him one better, yes, sir. As far as the nigger was concerned, Henry felt like he was pretty much okie-dokie. "Kid's a gone goose," Henry muttered, and made his shaky, staggering way past the floating balloon. Fresh blood glimmered on his hand as it continued to flow from his stomach. "Kid's all done. Greased the sucker. Gonna grease them all, teach them to throw rocks." The world was coming in slow, rolling waves. Big combers like the ones they used to show at the beginning of every Hawaii 5-0 episode on the Ward TV. "Book 'em, Dano. Ha-ha, Jack fucking Lord, okay." Jack fucking Lord was pretty much okie-dokie. And Henry could almost. Hear the sound those Oahu big boys make as they rise, curl, and shake. Shake, shake, shake. The reality of the world. Pipeline, Chantays. Remember Pipeline? Pipeline was pretty much okie-dokie. Wipeout. Crazy laugh there at the start. Sounded like Patrick Hockstetter. fucking queer boy. Got greased himself, and as far as I...
He was concerned. That was a fuck of a lot better than okie-dokie. That was just fine. That was just as fine as paint.
Okay, pipeline. Shoot the line. Don't back down. Not my boys. Catch a wave and... Shoot. Shoot, shoot, shoot. A wave and go sidewalk surfing with me. Shoot. The line. Shoot the world, but keep...
An ear inside his head. It kept hearing that kaspang sound. An eye inside his head. It kept seeing Victor's head rising on the end of that spring, eyelids and cheeks and forehead tattooed with rosettes of blood. Henry looked blearily to his left and saw that the houses had been replaced with a tall black stand of hedge. Looming above it was the narrow, gloomily Victorian pile of the theological seminary. Not a window shone light. The seminary had graduated its last class in June of 1974. It had closed its doors that summer, and now whatever walked there walked alone, and only by permission of the chattering women's club that called itself the Derry Historical Society. He came to the walk which led up to the front door. It was barred by a heavy chain from which a metal sign hung, "No trespassing," this order enforced by Derry Police Department. Henry's feet tangled on this track, and he fell heavily again. Whap! To the sidewalk. Up ahead, a car turned onto Kansas Street from Hawthorne. Its headlights washed down the street. Henry fought the dazzle long enough to see the lights on top. It was a fuzzmobile. He crawled under the chain and crabbed his way to the left, so he was behind the hedge. The night dew on his hot face was wonderful. He lay face down, turning his head from side to side, wetting his cheeks, drinking what he could drink. The police car floated by without slowing. Then suddenly its bubble lights came on, washing the darkness with erratic blue pulses of light. There was no need for the siren on the deserted streets, but Henry heard its mill suddenly crank up to full revs. Rubber blistered a startled scream from the pavement. "Caught, I'm caught," his mind gibbered. And then he realized that the police car was heading away from him, up Kansas Street. A moment later, a hellish warbling sound filled the night, heading toward him from the south. He imagined some huge, silky black cat loping through the dark, all green eyes and flexing pelt. It, in a new shape, coming for him, coming to gobble him up. Little by little, and only as the warbling began to veer away, he realized it was an ambulance heading in the direction the fuzzmobile had gone. He lay shuddering on the wet grass, too cold now, struggling.
"Fuzz it, cousin, buzz it, cousin, rock it, roll it, we got chicken in the barn, what barn, whose barn, my..."
Not to vomit. He was afraid that if he vomited, all of his guts would come up, and there were five of them still to get.
Ambulance and police car. Where are they heading? The library, of course. The nigger.
But they're too late. I greased him. Might as well turn off your siren, boys. He ain't gonna hear it. He's just as dead as a fence post. But was he? Henry licked his peeling lips with his arid tongue. If he was dead, there would be no warbling siren in the night. Not unless the nigger had called them. So maybe, just maybe, the nigger wasn't dead.
"No," Henry breathed. He rolled over on his back and stared up at the sky, at the billions of stars up there. It had come from there, he knew. From somewhere up in that sky. It.
Came from outer space with a lust for earth women, came to rob all the women and rape all the men.
"Say, Frank, don't you mean rob all the men and rape all the women? Who's running this show, Philly man? You were Jesse."
Victor used to tell that one, and that was pretty much.
Came from the spaces between the stars. Looking up at that starry sky gave him the creeps. It was too big, too black. It was all too possible to imagine it turning blood red, all too possible to imagine a face forming in lines of fire. He closed his eyes, shivering and holding his arms crossed on his belly, and he thought,
"The nigger is dead. Someone heard us fighting and sent the cops to investigate, that's all."
"Then why the ambulance?"
"Shut up, shut up," Henry groaned. He felt the old baffled rage again. He remembered how they had beaten him again and again in the old days that seemed so close and so vital now, how every time he believed he had them, they had somehow slipped through his fingers. It had been like that on the last day, after Belch saw the coups running down Kansas Street toward the Barrens. He remembered that, oh yes, he remembered that clearly enough. When you got kicked in the balls, you remembered it. It had happened to him again and again that summer. Henry struggled to a sitting position, wincing at the deep dagger of pain in his guts.
Victor and Belch had helped him down into the barrens. He had walked as fast as he could in spite of the agony that griped and pulled at his groin and the root of his belly. The time had come to finish it. They had followed the path to a clearing from which five or six paths radiated like strands of a spider web. Yes, there had been kids playing around there. You didn't have to be Tonto to see that. There were scraps of candy wrapper, the curled tail of a shot-off roll of bang caps, red and black, a few boards and a fluffy scatter of sawdust, as if something had been built there. He remembered standing in the center of the clearing and scanning the trees, looking for their baby treehouse. He would spot it, and then he would climb up and the girl would be cowering there, and he would use the knife to cut her throat and feel her titties nice and easy until they stopped moving. But he hadn't been able to see any treehouse. Neither had Belch or Victor. The old familiar frustration rose in his throat. He and Victor left Belch to guard the clearing while they went down the river. But there had been no sign of her there either. He remembered bending over and picking up a rock and... 8. The Barrens, 12:55 p.m. Heaving it far down the stream, furious and bewildered. "Where the fuck did she go?" he demanded, wheeling toward Victor. Victor shook his head slowly. "Don't know," he said. "You're bleeding." Henry looked down and saw a dark spot the size of a quarter on the crotch of his jeans. The pain had withdrawn to a low, throbbing ache, but his underpants felt too small and too tight. His balls were swelling. He felt that anger inside him again, something like a knotted rope around his heart. She had done this. "Where is she?" he hissed at Victor. "Don't know," Victor said again, in that same dull voice. He seemed hypnotized, sunstruck, not really there at all. "Ran away, I guess. She could be all the way over to the old Cape by now." "She's not," Henry said. "She's hiding. They've got a place and she's hiding there. Maybe it's not a treehouse. Maybe it's something else." "What?" "I don't know," Henry shouted, and Victor flinched back. Henry stood in the Kanduskeag, the cold water boiling over the tops of his sneakers, looking around. His eyes fixed on a cylinder poking out of the embankment about 20 feet downstream, a pumping station. He climbed out of the water and walked down to it, feeling a sort of necessary dread settle into him. His skin seemed to be tightening, his eyes widening so that they were able to see more and more. It seemed he could feel the tiny hairs in his ears stirring and moving like kelp in an underwater tidal flow. Low humming came from the pumping station, and beyond it he could see a pipe jutting out of the embankment over the Kanduskeag. A steady flow of sludge pulsed out of the pipe and ran into the water. He leaned over the cylinder's round iron top. "Henry?" Victor called nervously. "Henry, what you doing?" Henry paid no attention. He put his eye to one of the round holes in the iron and saw nothing but blackness. He exchanged eye for ear. "Wait." The voice drifted up to him from the blackness inside, and Henry felt his interior temperature plummet to zero, his veins and arteries freezing into crystal tubes of ice. But with these sensations came an almost unknown feeling. Love. His eyes widened. A clownish smile spread his lips in a large, nerveless arc. It was the voice from the moon. Now it was down in the pumping station, down in the drains. "Wait. Watch." He waited, but there was no more. Only the steady, soporific drone of the pumping machinery. He walked back down to where Victor stood on the bank, watching him cautiously. Henry ignored him and hollered for Belch. In a little while, Belch came. "Come on," he said. "What are we going to do, Henry?" Belch asked. "Wait. Watch." They crept back toward the clearing and sat down. Henry tried to pull his underpants away from his aching balls, but it hurt too much. "Henry, what?" Belch began. "Shh." Belch fell obligingly silent. Henry had camels, but he didn't share them out. He didn't want the bitch to smell cigarette smoke if she was around. He could have explained, but there was no need. The voice had spoken only two words to him, but these seemed to explain everything. They played down here. Soon the others would come back. Why settle for just the bitch when they could have all seven of the little shite pokes? They waited and watched. Victor and Belch seemed to have gone to sleep with their eyes open. It was not a long wait, but there was time for Henry to think of a good many things. how he had found the switchblade this morning, for instance. It wasn't the same one he'd had on the last day of school. He'd lost that one somewhere. This one looked a lot cooler. It came in the mail. Sort of. He had stood on the porch, looking at their battered, leaning RFD box, trying to grasp what he was seeing. The box was decked with balloons. Two were tied to the metal hook where the postman sometimes hung packages. Others were tied to the flag. Red, yellow, blue, green. It was as if some weird circus had crept by on Witcham Road in the dead of night, leaving this sign. As he approached the mailbox, he saw there were faces on the balloons. The faces of the kids who had deviled him all this summer, the kids who seemed to mock him at every turn. He had stared at these apparitions, gape-mouthed, and then the balloons popped one by one. That had been good. It was as if he were making them pop just by thinking about it, killing them with his mind. The front of the mailbox suddenly swung down. Henry walked toward it and peered in. Although the mailman didn't get this far out until the middle of the afternoon, Henry felt no surprise when he saw a flat rectangular package inside. He pulled it out. Mr. Henry Bowers, RFD, number 2, Derry, Maine, the address read. There was even a return address of sorts. Mr. Robert Gray, Derry, Maine. He opened the package, letting the brown paper drift down heedlessly by his feet. There was a white box inside. He opened it. Lying on a bed of white cotton had been the switch knife. He took it into the house. His father was lying on his pallet in the bedroom they shared, surrounded by empty beer cans, his belly bulging over the top of his yellow underpants. Henry knelt beside him, listening to the snort and flutter of his father's breathing, watching his father's horsey lips purse and pucker with each breath. Henry placed the business end of the switch knife against his father's scrawny neck. His father moved a little and then settled back into beery sleep again. Henry kept the knife like that for almost 5 minutes, his eyes distant and thoughtful, the ball of his left thumb caressing the silver button set into the switchblade's neck. The voice from the moon spoke to him. It whispered like the spring wind, which is warm with a cold blade buried somewhere in its middle. It buzzed like a paper nest full of roused hornets. It huckstered like a hoarse politician. Everything the voice said seemed pretty much okie-dokie to Henry, and so he pushed the silver button. There was a click inside the knife as the suicide spring let go, and 6 inches of steel drove through Butch Bauer's neck. It went in as easily as the tines of a meat fork into the breast of a well-roasted chicken. The tip of the blade popped out on the other side, dripping. Butch's eyes flew open. He stared at the ceiling. His mouth dropped open. Blood ran from the corners of it and down his cheeks toward the lobes of his ears. He began to gurgle. A large blood bubble formed between his slack lips and popped. One of his hands crept to Henry's knee and squeezed convulsively. Henry didn't mind. Presently the hand fell away. The gurgling noises stopped a moment later. Butch Bowers was dead. Henry pulled the knife out, wiped it on the dirty sheet that covered his father's pallet, and pushed the blade back in until the spring clicked again. He looked at his father without much interest. The voice had told him about the day's work while he knelt beside Butch with the knife against Butch's neck. The voice had explained everything. So he went into the other room to call Belch and Victor. Now here they were, all three, and although his balls still ached horribly, the knife made a comforting bulge in his left front pants pocket. He felt that the cutting would begin soon. The others would come back down to resume whatever baby game they had been playing, and then the cutting would begin. The voice from the moon had laid it out for him as he knelt by his father, and on his way into town he had been unable to take his eyes from that pale ghost disk in the sky. He saw that there was indeed a man in the moon, a grisly, glimmering ghost face with cratered holes for eyes and a glabrous grin that seemed to reach halfway up its cheekbones. It talked. "We float down here, Henry. We all float. You'll float, too." "All the way to town." "Kill them all, Henry," the ghost voice from the moon said. And Henry could dig it. Henry felt he could second that emotion. He would kill them all, his tormentors, and then those feelings that he was losing his grip, that he was coming inexorably to a larger world he would not be able to dominate, as he had dominated the play yard at Derry Elementary, that in the wider world the fat boy and the nigger and the stuttering freak might somehow grow larger while he somehow only grew older, would be gone. He would kill them all, and the voices, those inside and the one which spoke to him from the moon, would leave him alone. He would kill them and then go back to the house and sit on the back porch with his father's souvenir Jap sword across his lap. He would drink one of his father's Rheingolds. He would listen to the radio, too, but no baseball. Baseball was strictly Squaresville. He would listen to rock and roll instead. Although Henry didn't know it, and wouldn't have cared if he did, on this one subject he and the losers agreed. Rock and roll was pretty much okey-dokey. We got chicken in the barn. Whose barn? What barn? My barn. Everything would be good then. Everything would be the ginchiest then. Everything would be okay fine then. And anything which might come next would not matter. The voice would take care of him. He sensed that. If you took care of it, it would take care of you. That was how things had always been in Derry. But the kids had to be stopped. Stopped soon. Stopped today. The voice had told him so. Henry took his new knife out of his pocket, looked at it, turned it this way and that, admiring the way the sun winked and slid off the chrome facing. Then Belch was grabbing his arm and hissing, "Look at that, Henry! Cheesley, old crow, look at that!" Henry looked and felt the clear light of understanding burst over him. A square section of the clearing was rising as if by magic, revealing a growing slice of darkness beneath. For just a moment he felt a jolt of terror as it occurred to him that this might be the owner of the voice, for surely it lived somewhere under the city. Then he heard the gritty squall of dirt in the hinges and understood. They hadn't been able to see the treehouse because there was none. "By God, we was standing right on top of them," Victor grunted, and as Ben's head and shoulders appeared in the square hatchway in the center of the clearing, he made as if to charge forward. Henry grabbed him and held him back. "Ain't we going to get him, Henry?" Victor asked as Ben boosted himself up. "We'll get him," Henry said, never taking his eyes from the hated fat boy. "Another ball kicker. I'll kick your balls so high up you can wear them for earrings, you fat fuck. Wait and see if I don't." "Don't worry." The fat boy was helping the bitch out of the hole. She looked around doubtfully, and for a moment Henry believed she looked right at him. Then her eyes passed on. The two of them murmured together, and then they pushed their way into the thick undergrowth and were gone. "Come on," Henry said, when the sound of snapping branches and rustling leaves had faded almost to inaudibility. "We'll follow them, but keep back and keep quiet. I want them all together." The three of them crossed the clearing like soldiers on patrol, bent low, their eyes wide and moving. Belch paused to look down into the clubhouse and shook his head in admiring wonder. "Sitting right over their heads, I was," he said. Henry motioned him forward impatiently. They took the path because it was quieter. They were halfway back to Kansas Street when the bitch and the fat boy, holding hands, "Isn't that cute?" Henry thought, in a kind of ecstasy, emerged almost directly in front of them. Luckily, their backs were to Henry's group, and neither of them looked around. Henry, Victor, and Belch froze, then drew into the shadows at the side of the path. Soon Ben and Beverly were just two shirts seen through a tangle of shrubs and bushes. The three of them began to pursue again, cautiously. Henry took the knife out again and... 9. Henry gets a lift. 2:30 a.m. Pressed the chrome button in the handle. The blade popped out. He looked at it dreamily in the moonlight. He liked the way the starlight ran along the blade. He had no idea exactly what time it was. He was drifting in and out of reality now. A sound impinged on his consciousness and began to grow. It was a car engine. It drew closer. Henry's eyes widened in the dark. He held the knife more tightly, waiting for the car to pass by. It didn't. It drew up at the curb beyond the seminary hedge and simply stopped there, engine idling. Grimacing, his belly was stiffening now. It had gone bored hard, and the blood seeping sluggishly between his fingers had the consistency of sap just before you took the taps out of the maples in late March or early April. He got on his knees and pushed aside the stiff hedge branches. He could see headlights in the shape of a car. Cops? His hand squeezed the knife and relaxed, squeezed and relaxed, squeezed and relaxed. "I sent you a ride, Henry," the voice whispered. "Sort of a taxi, if you can dig that. After all, we have to get you over there to the townhouse pretty soon. The night's getting old." The voice uttered one thin bone-like chuckle and fell silent. Now the only sounds were the crickets and the steady rumble of the idling car. "Sounds like cherry bomb mufflers," Henry thought distractedly. He got awkwardly to his feet and worked his way back to the seminary walk. He peeked around at the car. Not a Fuzzmobile. No bubbles on the roof, and the shape was all wrong. The shape was old. Henry heard that giggle again. Or perhaps it was only the wind. He emerged from the shadow of the hedge, crawled under the chain, got to his feet again, and began to walk toward the idling car, which existed in a black-and-white Polaroid snapshot world of bright moonlight and impenetrable shadow. Henry was a mess. His shirt was black with blood, and it had soaked through his jeans almost to the knees. His face was a white blotch under an institutional crew cut. He reached the intersection of the seminary path and the sidewalk and peered at the car, trying to make sense out of the hulk behind the wheel. But it was the car he recognized first. It was the one his father always swore he would own someday, a 1958 Plymouth Fury. It was red and white, and Henry knew, hadn't his father told him often enough, that the engine rumbling under the hood was a V8 327. Available horsepower of 255, able to hit 70 from the get-go in just about 9 seconds, gobbling high test through its four-barrel carb. "I'm going to get that car, and then when I die, they can bury me in it," Butch had been fond of saying. Except, of course, he had never gotten the car, and the state had buried him after Henry had been taken away, raving and screaming of monsters, to the funny farm. "If that's him inside, I don't think I can take it," Henry thought. Squeezing down on the knife, swaying drunkenly back and forth, looking at the shape behind the wheel. Then the passenger door of the Fury swung open, the dome light came on, and the driver turned to look at him. It was Belch Huggins. His face was a hanging ruin. One of his eyes was gone, and a rotted hole in one parchment cheek revealed blackened teeth. Perched on Belch's head was the New York Yankees baseball cap he had been wearing the day he died. It was turned around backward. Gray-green mold oozed along the bill. "Belch!" Henry cried, and agony ripped its way up from his belly, making him cry out again wordlessly. Belch's dead lips stretched in a grin, splitting open in whitish-gray bloodless folds. He held one twisted hand out toward the open door in invitation. Henry hesitated, then shuffled around the Fury's grill, allowing one hand to touch the V-shaped emblem there, just as he had always touched it when his father took him into the Bangor showroom when he was a kid to look at the same car. As he reached the passenger side, grayness overwhelmed him in a soft wave, and he had to grab the open door to keep his feet. He stood there, head down, breathing in snuffling gasps. At last the world came back, part way anyhow, and he was able to work his way around the door and fall into the seat. Pain skewered his guts again, and fresh blood squirted out into his hand. It felt like warm jelly. He put his head back and gritted his teeth, the cords on his neck standing out. At last the pain began to subside a little. The door swung shut by itself. The dome light went out. Henry saw one of Belch's rotted hands close over the transmission lever and drop it into drive. The bunched white knots of Belch's knuckles glimmered through the decaying flesh of his fingers. The Fury began to move down Kansas Street toward Upmile Hill. "How you doing, Belch?" Henry heard himself say. It was stupid, of course. Belch couldn't be here. Dead people couldn't drive cars. But it was all he could think of. Belch didn't reply. His one sunken eye stared at the road. His teeth glared sickly at Henry through the hole in his cheek. Henry became vaguely aware that old Belch smelled pretty ripe. Old Belch smelled, in fact, like a bushel basket of tomatoes that had gone bad and watery. The glove compartment flopped open, banging Henry's knees. And in the light of the small bulb inside, he saw a bottle of Texas Driver half full. He took it out, opened it, and had himself a good shot. It went down like cool silk and hit his stomach like an explosion of lava. He shuddered all over, moaning, and then began to feel a little better, a little more connected to the world. "Thanks," he said. Belch's head turned toward him. Henry could hear the tendons in Belch's neck. The sound was like the scream of rusty screen door hinges. Belch regarded him for a moment with a dead, one-eyed stare, and Henry realized for the first time that most of Belch's nose was gone. It looked like something had been at the old Belcher's nose. Dog, maybe. Or maybe rats. Rats seemed more likely. The tunnels they had chased the little kids into that day had been full of rats. Moving just as slowly, Belch's head turned toward the road again. Henry was glad. Old Belch staring at him that way. Well, Henry hadn't been able to dig it too much. There had been something in Belch's single sunken eye. Reproach? Anger? What? There is a dead boy behind the wheel of this car.
Henry looked down at his arm and saw that huge goosebumps had formed there. He quickly had another snort from the bottle. This one hit a little easier and spread its warmth farther. The Plymouth rolled down Up Mile Hill and made its way around the counterclockwise traffic circle. Except at this time of night there was no traffic. All the traffic lights had changed to yellow blinkers splashing the empty streets and closed buildings with steady pulses of light. It was so quiet that Henry could hear the relays clicking inside each light. Or was that his imagination?
"Never meant to leave you behind that day, Belcher," Henry said. "I mean, if that was, you know, on your mind."
The scream of dried tendons again. Belch looking at him again with his one sunken eye, and his lips stretched in a terrible grin that revealed gray-black gums which were growing their own garden of mold.
"What sort of a grin is that?"
Henry asked himself as the car purred silkily up Main Street, past Freese's on the one side, Nan's Luncheonette, and the Aladdin Theater on the other.
"Is it a forgiving grin? An old pal's grin? Or is it the kind of grin that says, 'I'm going to get you, Henry. I'm going to get you for running out on me and Vic.' What kind of grin?"
"You have to understand how it was," Henry said, and then stopped.
How had it been? It was all confused in his mind, the pieces jumbled up like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that had just been dumped out on one of the shitty card tables in the rec room at Juniper Hill. How had it been, exactly?
They had followed the fat boy and the bitch back to Kansas Street and had waited back in the bushes, watching them climb up the embankment to the top. If they had disappeared from view, he and Victor and Belch would have dropped the stalking game and simply gone after them. Two of them were better than none at all, and the rest would be along in time. But they hadn't disappeared. They had simply leaned against the fence, talking and watching the street. Every now and then they would check down the slope into the barrens, but Henry kept his two troops well out of sight. The sky, Henry remembered, had become overcast, clouds moving in from the east, the air thickening. There would be rain that afternoon.
What had happened next? What?
A bony, leathery hand closed over his forearm and Henry screamed. He had been drifting away again into that cottony grayness, but Belch's dreadful touch and the dagger of pain in his stomach from the scream brought him back. He looked around and Belch's face was less than 2 inches from Henry's. He gasped in breath and wished he hadn't. The old Belcher really had gone to seed. Henry was again reminded of tomatoes going quietly putrescent in some shadowy shed corner. His stomach roiled. He remembered the end suddenly, the end for Belch and Vic, anyway. How something had come out of the darkness as they stood in a shaft with a sewer grating at the top, wondering which way to go next.
Something.
Henry hadn't been able to tell what, until Victor shrieked,
"Frankenstein! It's Frankenstein!"
And so it was. It was the Frankenstein monster, with bolts coming out of its neck and a deep-stitched scar across its forehead, lurching along in shoes like a child's blocks.
"Frankenstein!" Vic had screamed.
And then Vic's head was gone. Vic's head was flying across the shaftway to strike the stonework of the far side with a sour, sticky thud. The monster's watery yellow eyes had fallen on Henry, and Henry had frozen. His bladder let go and he felt warmth flood down his legs. The creature lurched toward him and Belch. Belch had...
"Listen, I know I ran," Henry said. "I shouldn't have done that, but... but..."
Belch only stared.
"I got lost," Henry whispered, as if to tell the old Belcher that he had paid too. It sounded weak, like saying, "Yeah, I know you got killed, Belch, but I got one fuck of a splinter under my thumbnail."
But it had been bad, really bad. He had wandered around in a world of stinking darkness for hours, and finally, he remembered, he had started to scream. At some point he had fallen, a long, dizzying fall, in which he had time to think, "Oh, good, in a minute I'll be dead. I'll be out of this." And then he had been in fast-running water, under the canal, he supposed. He had come out into fading sunlight, had flailed his way toward the bank, and had finally climbed out of the Kanduskeag less than 50 yards from the place where Adrian Mellon would drown 26 years later. He slipped, fell, bashed his head, blacked out. When he woke up, it was after dark. He had somehow found his way out to Route 2 and had hooked a ride to the home place. And there the cops had been waiting for him.
but that was then and this was now. Belch had stepped in front of Frankenstein's monster, and it had peeled the left side of his face down to the skull. So much Henry had seen before fleeing. But now Belch was back, and Belch was pointing at something. Henry saw that they had pulled up in front of the Derry townhouse, and suddenly he understood perfectly. The townhouse was the only real hotel left in Derry. Back in 58, there had also been the Eastern Star at the end of Exchange Street and the Traveler's Rest on Tyrault Street. Both had disappeared during urban renewal. Henry knew all about this. He had read the Derry News faithfully every day in Juniper Hill. Only the townhouse was left, and a bunch of ticky-tacky little motels out by the interstate. "That's where they'll be," he thought. "Right in there. All of them that are left. Asleep in their beds with visions of sugar plums. Or sewers, maybe, dancing in their heads. And I'll get them. One by one, I'll get them." He took the bottle of Texas Driver out again and bit off a snort. He could feel fresh blood trickling into his lap, and the seat was tacky beneath him, but the wine made it better. The wine seemed to make it not matter. He could have done with some good bourbon, but the driver was better than nothing. "Look," he said to Belch, "I'm sorry I ran. I don't know why I ran. Please, don't be mad." Belch spoke for the first and only time, but the voice wasn't his voice. The voice that came from Belch's rotting mouth was deep and powerful, terrifying. Henry whimpered at the sound of it. It was the voice from the moon, the voice of the clown, the voice he had heard in his dreams of drains and sewers where water rushed on and on. "Just shut up and get them," the voice said.
"Sure,"
Henry whined. "Sure, okay, I want to, no problem." He put the bottle back in the glove compartment. Its neck chattered briefly like teeth. And he saw a paper where the bottle had been. He took it out and unfolded it, leaving bloody fingerprints on the corners. Embossed across the top was this logo in bright scarlet. A memo from Pennywise. Below this, carefully printed in capital letters. Bill Denbro, 311. Ben Hanscom, 404. Eddie Kasprak, 609. Beverly Marsh, 518. Richie Tozier, 217. Their room numbers. That was good. That saved time. Thanks, Beth. But Belch was gone. The driver's seat was empty. There was only the New York Yankees baseball cap lying there, mold crusted on its bill, and some slimy stuff on the knob of the gear shift. Henry stared, his heart beating painfully in his throat. And then he seemed to hear something move and shift in the back seat. He got out quickly, opening the door and almost falling to the pavement in his haste. He gave the Fury, which still burbled softly through its dual cherry bomb mufflers. Cherry bombs had been outlawed in the state of Maine in 1962. A wide berth. It was hard to walk. Each step pulled and tore at his belly. But he gained the sidewalk and stood there, looking at the eight-floor brick building which, along with the library and the Aladdin Theater and the seminary, was one of the few he remembered clearly from the old days. Most of the lights on the upper floors were out now, but the frosted glass globes which flanked the main doorway blazed softly in the darkness, haloed with moisture from the lingering ground fog. Henry made his laborious way toward and between them, shouldering open one of the doors. The lobby was wee hours silent. There was a faded Turkish rug on the floor. The ceiling was a huge mural, executed in rectangular panels, which showed scenes from Derry's logging days. There were overstuffed sofas and wing chairs and a great fireplace, which was now dead and silent, a birch log thrown across the andirons. A real log, no gas. The fireplace in the townhouse was not just a piece of lobby stage dressing. Plants spilled out of low pots. The glass double doors leading to the bar and the restaurant were closed. From some inner office, Henry could hear the gabble of a TV turned low. He lurched across the lobby, his pants and shirt streaked with blood. Blood was grimed into the folds of his hands. It ran down his cheeks and slashed his forehead like war paint. His eyes bulged from their sockets. Anyone in the lobby who had seen him would have run screaming in terror. But there was no one. The elevator doors opened as soon as he pushed the up button. He looked at the paper in his hand, then at the floor buttons. After a moment of deliberation, he pushed 6, and the doors closed. There was a faint hum of machinery as the elevator began to rise. Might as well start at the top and work my way down.
He slumped against the rear wall of the car, eyes half closed. The hum of the elevator was soothing, like the hum of the machinery in the pumping stations of the drainage system.
That day, it kept coming back to him, how everything seemed almost prearranged, as if all of them were just playing parts. How Vic and the old Belcher had seemed, well, almost drugged. He remembered.
The car came to a stop, jolting him and sending another wave of griping pain into his stomach. The doors slid open. Henry stepped out into the silent hallway. More plants here, hanging ones, spider plants. He didn't want to touch any of them, not those oozy green runners. They reminded him too much of the things that had been hanging down there in the dark. He rechecked the paper. Kasprak was in 609. Henry started down that way, running one hand along the wall for support, leaving a faint bloody track on the wallpaper as he went.
Ah, but he stepped away whenever he came close to one of the hanging spider plants. He wanted no truck with those.
His breathing was harsh and dry. Here it was. Henry pulled the switchblade from his pocket, swashed his dry lips with his tongue, and knocked on the door. Nothing. He knocked again, louder this time.
Who's it?
Sleepy, good. He'd be in his jammies, only half awake.
And when he opened the door, Henry would drive the switchblade directly into the hollow at the base of his neck, the vulnerable hollow just below the Adam's apple.
Bellboy, sir, Henry said. Message from your wife.
Did Kasprak have a wife? Maybe that had been a stupid thing to say. He waited, coldly alert. He heard footsteps, the shuffle of slippers.
From Myra?
He sounded alarmed. Good. He would be more alarmed in a few seconds.
A pulse beat steadily in Henry's right temple.
I guess so, sir. There's no name. It just says your wife.
There was a pause, then a metallic rattle as Kasprak fumbled with the chain. Grinning, Henry pushed the button on the switchblade's handle.
Click.
He held the blade up by his cheek, ready. He heard the thumb bolt turn. In just a moment, he would plunge the blade into the skinny little creep's throat. He waited. The door opened, and Eddie... 10. The losers all together. 1:20 p.m. Saw Stan and Richie just coming out of the Costello Avenue market, each of them eating a rocket on a push-up stick.
Hey,
he shouted. Hey, wait up. They turned around and Stan waved. Eddie ran to join them as quickly as he could, which was not, in truth, very quickly. One arm was immured in a plaster of Paris cast, and he had his Parcheesi board under the other.
What you say, Eddie? What you say, boy?
Richie asked in his grandly rolling southern gentleman voice. The one that sounded more like Foghorn Leghorn in the Warner Brothers cartoons than anything else.
I say, the boy's got a broken arm. Look at that, Stan. The boy's got a broken arm. I say, be a good spote and carry the boy's Parcheesi board for him.
I can carry it, Eddie said, a little out of breath. How about a lick on your rocket?
Your mom wouldn't approve, Eddie, Richie said sadly. He began to eat faster. He had just gotten to the chocolate stuff in the middle, his favorite part.
Germs, boy. I say, you can get germs eaten after someone else.
I'll chance it, Eddie said.
Reluctantly, Richie held his rocket up to Eddie's mouth and snatched it away quickly as soon as Eddie had gotten in a couple of moderately serious licks.
You can have the rest of mine if you want, Stan said. I'm still full from lunch.
Jews don't eat much, Richie instructed. It's part of their religion.
The three of them were walking along companionably enough now, headed up toward Kansas Street and the Barrens. Derry seemed lost in a deep, hazy afternoon doze. The blinds of most of the houses they passed were pulled down. Toys stood abandoned on lawns, as if their owners had been hastily called in from play or put down for naps. Thunder rumbled thickly in the west.
Is it? Eddie asked Stan.
No, Richie's just pulling your leg, Stan said. Jews eat as much as normal people.
He pointed at Richie, like him.
You know, you're pretty fucking mean to Stan, Eddie told Richie. How would you like somebody to say all that made-up shit about you just because you're a Catholic?
Oh, Catholics do plenty, Richie said. My dad told me once that Hitler was a Catholic, and Hitler killed billions of Jews, right, Stan?
Yeah, I guess so, Stan said. He looked embarrassed.
My mom was furious when my dad told me that. Richie went on. A little reminiscent grin had surfaced on his face. Absolutely furious.
Us Catholics also had the Inquisition. That was the little dealy with the rack and the thumbscrews and all that stuff. I figure all religions are pretty weird.
Me too, Stan said quietly. We're not Orthodox or anything like that. I mean, we eat ham and bacon. I hardly even know what being a Jew is. I was born in Derry, and sometimes we go up to synagogue in Bangor for stuff like Yom Kippur, but... He shrugged.
Ham? Bacon?
Eddie was mystified. He and his mom were Methodists.
Orthodox Jews don't eat stuff like that, Stan said. It says something in the Torah about not eating anything that creeps through the mud or walks on the bottom of the ocean. I don't know exactly how it goes, but pigs are supposed to be out, also lobster. But my folks eat them. I do too.
That's weird, Eddie said and burst out laughing. I never heard of a religion that told you what you could eat. Next thing, they'll be telling you what kind of gas you can buy.
Kosher gas, Stan said, and laughed by himself. Neither Richie nor Eddie understood what he was laughing about.
You gotta admit, Stanny, it is pretty weird, Richie said. I mean, not being able to eat a sausage just because you happen to be Jewish.
Yeah? Stan said.
You eat meat on Fridays?
Geez, no, Richie said, shocked. You can't eat meat on Friday because...
He began to grin a little.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean.
Do Catholics really go to hell if they eat meat on Fridays?
Eddie asked, fascinated, totally unaware that until two generations before, his own people had been devout Polish Catholics who would no more have eaten meat on Friday than they would have gone outside with no clothes on.
Well, I'll tell you what, Eddie, Richie said. I don't really think God would send me down to the hot place just for forgetting and having a bologna sandwich for lunch on a Friday. But why take a chance, right?
I guess not, Eddie said. But it seems so stupid, he was going to say. And then he remembered a story Mrs. Portlay had told the Sunday school class when he was just a little kid. A first grader in Little Worshippers. According to Mrs. Portlay, a bad boy had once stolen some of the communion bread when the tray was passed and put it in his pocket. He took it home and threw it into the toilet bowl just to see what would happen. At once, or so Mrs. Portlay reported to her rapt Little Worshippers, the water in the toilet bowl had turned a bright red. It was the blood of Christ, she said, and it had appeared to that little boy because he had done a very bad act called a blasphemy. It had appeared to warn him that, by throwing the flesh of Jesus into the toilet, he had put his immortal soul in danger of hell. Up until then, Eddie had rather enjoyed the act of communion, which he had only been allowed to take since the previous year. The Methodists used Welch's grape juice instead of wine, and the body of Christ was represented by cut-up cubes of fresh, springy Wonder Bread. He liked the idea of taking in food and drink as a religious rite. But following Mrs. Portlay's story, his awe of the ritual darkened into something more potent, something rather dreadful. Simply reaching for the cubes of bread became an act which required courage, and he always feared an electrical shock, or worse, that the bread would suddenly change color in his hand, become a blood clot, and a disembodied voice would begin to thunder in the church, "Not worthy, not worthy, damned to hell, damned to hell." Often, after he had taken communion, his throat would close up, his breath would begin to wheeze in and out, and he would wait with panicky impatience for the benediction to be over, so he could hurry into the vestibule and use his aspirator.
"You don't want to be so silly," he told himself as he grew older. "That was nothing but a story, and Mrs. Portlay sure wasn't any saint. Mama said she was divorced down in Kittery, and that she plays bingo at St. Mary's in Bangor, and that real Christians don't gamble. Real Christians leave gambling for pagans and Catholics."
All that made perfect sense, but it didn't relieve his mind. The story of the communion bread that turned the water in the toilet bowl to blood worried at him, gnawed at him, even caused him to lose sleep. It came to him one night that the way to get this behind him once and for all would be to take a piece of the bread himself, toss it in the toilet, and see what happened. But such an experiment was far beyond his courage. His rational mind could not stand against that sinister image of the blood spreading its cloud of accusation and potential damnation in the water. It could not stand against that talismanic magical incantation. "This is my body. Take, eat. This is my blood, shed for you and for many." No, he had never made the experiment.
"I guess all religions are weird," Eddie said now. "But powerful," his mind added, "almost magical." Or was that blasphemy?
He began to think about the thing they had seen on Niebold Street, and for the first time he saw a crazy parallel. The werewolf had, after all, come out of the toilet. "Boy, I guess everybody's asleep," Richie said, tossing his empty rocket tube nonchalantly into the gutter. "You ever see it so quiet? What, did everybody go to Bar Harbor for the day?" "Hey, you guys!" Bill Denbro shouted from behind them. "Hate up!" Eddie turned, delighted as always to hear Big Bill's voice. He was wheeling Silver around the corner of Costello Avenue, outdistancing Mike, although Mike Schwinn was almost brand new. "Hi-yo, Silver! Away!" Bill yelled. He rolled up to them, doing perhaps 20 miles an hour, the playing cards clothespinned to the fender struts roaring. Then he backpedaled, locked the brakes, and produced an admirably long skid mark. "Stuttering Bill," Richie said. "How are you, boy?"
I say, how are you, boy?"
I'm okay, Bill said. "Seen Ben or Bubba Heverly?" Mike rode up and joined them. Sweat stood out on his face in little drops. "How fast does that bike go, anyway?" Bill laughed.
I don't know exactly.
"Pretty fast. "I haven't seen them," Richie said. "They're probably down there, hanging out, singing two-part harmony. Shaboom, shaboom, yada-da-da-da-da-da. You look like a dream, sweetheart."
Stan Uris made throwing up noises.
"He's just jealous," Richie said to Mike. "Jews can't sing."
"Ba-ba-ba."
"Beep, beep, Richie," Richie said for him, and they all laughed. They started toward the Barrens again, Mike and Bill pushing their bikes. Conversation was brisk at first, but then it lagged. Looking at Bill, Eddie saw an uneasy look on his face, and he thought that maybe the quiet was getting to him, too. He knew Richie had meant it as a joke, but it really did seem that everyone in Derry had gone to Bar Harbor for the day. To somewhere. Not a car moved on the street. There wasn't a single old lady pushing a carrier full of groceries back to her house or apartment.
"Sure is quiet, isn't it?"
Eddie ventured, but Bill only nodded. They crossed to the barren side of Kansas Street, and then they saw Ben and Beverly running toward them, shouting. Eddie was shocked by Beverly's appearance. She was usually so neat and clean, her hair always washed and tied back in a ponytail. Now she was streaked with what looked like every kind of gluck in the universe. Her eyes were wide and wild. There was a scratch on one cheek, her jeans were caked with crap, and her blouse was torn. Ben fell behind her, puffing, his stomach wobbling.
"Can't go down in the barrens," Beverly was panting. "The boys, Henry, Victor, they're down there somewhere. The knife. He has a knife."
Slow down, Bill said, taking charge at once in that effortless, almost unconscious way of his. He glanced at Ben as he ran up, his cheeks flushed bright, his considerable chest heaving.
"She says Henry's gone crazy, Big Bill," Ben said.
"Shit, you mean he used to be sane?" Richie asked and spat between his teeth.
Shut up, Richie, Bill said, and then looked back at Beverly. "To tell," he said.
Eddie's hand crept into his pocket and touched his aspirator. He didn't know what all this was, but he already knew it wasn't good. Forcing herself to speak as calmly as possible, Beverly managed to get out an edited version of the story, a version that began with Henry, Victor, and Belch catching up to her on the street. She didn't tell them about her father. She was desperately ashamed of that. When she was finished, Bill stood silent for a moment, hands in his pockets, chin down, Silver's handlebars leaning against his chest. The others waited, throwing frequent glances at the railing that ran along the edge of the drop-off. Bill thought for a long time, and no one interrupted him. Eddie became aware, suddenly and effortlessly, that this might be the final act. That was how the day's silence felt, wasn't it? The feeling that the whole town had up and left, leaving only the deserted husks of buildings behind? Richie was thinking about the picture in George's album that had suddenly come to life. Beverly was thinking about her father, how pale his eyes had been. Mike was thinking about the bird. Ben was thinking about the mummy and a smell like dead cinnamon. Stan Uris was thinking of blue jeans, black and dripping, and hands as white as wrinkled paper, also dripping.
Come on.
Bill said at last. Well, we're going to the down.
Bill,
Ben said. His face was troubled. Beverly said Henry was really crazy, that he meant to kill...
It's not theirs,
Bill said, gesturing at the green, dagger-shaped slash of the barrens to their right and below them. The underbrush, the choked groves of trees, the bamboo, the glint of water.
It's not their property.
He looked around at them, his face grim. I'm tired of being harried by them. We beat them in the rock fight. And if we have to beat them again, we'll do it.
But Bill, Eddie said, what if it's not just them?
Bill turned to Eddie, and with real shock, Eddie saw how tired and drawn Bill's face was. There was something frightening about that face, but it wasn't until much, much later, as an adult drifting toward sleep after the meeting at the library, that he understood what that frightening thing was. It was the face of a boy driven close to the brink of madness, a boy who was perhaps ultimately no more sane or in control of his own decisions than Henry was. Yet the essential Bill was still there, looking out of those haunted, scarified eyes. An angry, determined Bill. Well, he said, what if it's not? No one answered him. Thunder boomed, closer now. Eddie looked at the sky and saw the storm clouds moving in from the west in black thunderheads. It was going to rain a bitch, as his mother sometimes said.
How I'll tell you what, Bill said, looking at them. None of you have to go with me if you don't want to. That's up to you.
I'll go along, Big Bill, Richie said quietly.
Me too, Ben said.
Sure, Mike said with a shrug. Beverly and Stan agreed, and Eddie last.
I don't think so, Eddie, Richie said. Your arm's not, looking too cool.
Eddie looked at Bill.
I will want him, Bill said. You will walk with me, Eddie. I'll keep an eye on you.
Thanks, Bill, Eddie said. Bill's tired, half-crazy face seemed suddenly lovely to him, lovely and well-loved. He felt a dim sense of amazement.
I'd die for him, I guess, if he told me to. What kind of power is that? If it makes you look like Bill looks now, it's maybe not such a good power to have.
Yeah, Bill's got the ultimate weapon, Richie said. B.O. bombs. He raised his left arm and fluttered his right hand under the exposed armpit. Ben and Mike laughed a little, and Eddie smiled. Thunder boomed again, close and loud enough this time to make them jump and huddle closer together. The wind was picking up, rattling trash around in the gutter. The first of the dark clouds sailed over the hazy, ringed disk of the sun, and their shadows melted away. The wind was cold, chilling the sweat on Eddie's uncovered arm. He shivered. Bill looked at Stan and said a peculiar thing then.
You got your bird book, Stan?
Stan tapped his hip pocket.
Bill looked at them again. Let's go down, he said.
They went down the embankment single file, except for Bill, who stayed with Eddie as he had promised. He allowed Richie to push Silver down, and when they had reached the bottom, Bill put his bike in its accustomed place under the bridge. Then they stood together, looking around. The coming storm did not produce a darkness, not even precisely a dimness. But the quality of the light had changed, and things stood out in a kind of dreamlike, steely relief. Shadowless, clear, chiseled. Eddie felt a sinking of horror and apprehension in his guts as he realized why the quality of this light seemed so familiar. It was the same sort of light he remembered from the house at 29 Niebolt Street. A streak of lightning tattooed the clouds, bright enough to make him wince. He put a hand up to his face and found himself counting. One, two, three. And then the thunder came in a single coughing bark, an explosive sound, a sound like an M-80 firecracker, and they drew even closer together.
Wasn't any rain forecast this morning, Ben said uneasily. The paper said hot and hazy.
Mike was scanning the sky. The clouds up there were black-bottomed keelboats, high and heavy, swiftly overrunning the blue haze that had covered the sky from horizon to horizon when he and Bill came out of the Denbro house after lunch.
It's coming fast, he said. Never saw a storm come so fast.
And as if in confirmation, thunder whacked again.
Come on, Bill said. Let's put Eddie's Parcheesi board in the clubhouse.
They started along the path they had beaten in the weeks since the incident of the dam. Bill and Eddie were at the head of the line, their shoulders brushing the broad green leaves of the shrubs, the others behind them. The wind gusted again, making the leaves on the trees and bushes whisper together. Farther ahead, the bamboo rattled eerily, like drums in a jungle tale.
Bill?
Eddie said in a low voice.
What? I thought this was just in the movies, but...
Eddie laughed a little.
I feel like somebody's watching me.
Oh, they're all river right, Bill said.
Eddie looked around nervously and held his Parcheesi board a little tighter. 11. Eddie's room, 3.05 a.m. Opened the door on a monster from a horror comic. A gore-streaked apparition stood there, and it could only be Henry Bowers. Henry looked like a corpse which has returned from the grave. Henry's face was a frozen witch doctor's mask of hate and murder. His right hand was cocked at cheek level, and even as Eddie's eyes widened and he began to draw in his first shocked breath, the hand pistoned forward, the switchblade glittering like silk. With no thought, there was no time. If he had stopped to think, he would have died. Eddie slammed the door closed. It struck Henry's forearm, deflecting the knife's course so that it swung in a savage side-to-side arc less than an inch from Eddie's neck. There was a crunch as the door pinched Henry's arm against the jamb. Henry uttered a muffled cry. His hand opened. The knife clattered to the floor. Eddie kicked it. It skittered under the TV. Henry threw his weight against the door. He outweighed Eddie by over 100 pounds, and Eddie was driven back like a doll. His knees struck the bed, and he fell on it. Henry came into the room and swept the door shut behind him. He twisted the thumb bolt as Eddie sat up, wide-eyed, his throat already starting to whistle.
"Okay, fag,"
Henry said. His eyes dropped momentarily to the floor, hunting for the knife. He didn't see it. Eddie groped on the night table and found one of the two bottles of Perrier water he had ordered earlier that day. This was the full one. He had drunk the other before going to the library because his nerves were shot and he had a bad case of acid burn. Perrier was very good for the digestion. As Henry dismissed the knife and started toward him, Eddie gripped the green pear-shaped bottle by the neck and smashed it on the edge of the night table. Perrier foamed and fizzed across it, flooding out most of the pill bottles that stood there. Henry's shirt and pants were heavy with blood, both fresh and semi-dried. His right hand now hung at a strange angle.
"Baby fag," Henry said, "teach you to throw rocks."
He made it to the bed and reached for Eddie, who still hardly realized what was happening. No more than 40 seconds had elapsed since he had opened the door. Henry grabbed for him. Eddie thrust the ragged base of the Perrier bottle at him. It ripped into Henry's face, pulling open his right cheek in a twisted flap and puncturing Henry's right eye. Henry uttered a breathless scream and staggered backward. His slit eye, leaking whitish-yellow fluid, hung loosely from its socket. His cheek sprayed blood in a gaudy fountain. Eddie's own cry was louder. He got off the bed and went toward Henry. To help him, perhaps, he wasn't really sure. And Henry lurched at him again. Eddie thrust with the Perrier bottle as if with a fencing sword, and this time the jagged points of green glass punched deep into Henry's left hand and sawed at his fingers. Fresh blood flowed. Henry made a thick grunting noise, the sound almost of a man clearing his throat, and shoved Eddie with his right hand. Eddie flew back and struck the writing desk. His left arm twisted behind him somehow, and he fell on it heavily. The pain was a sudden sickening flare. He felt the bone go along the fault line of that old break, and he had to clench his teeth against a scream of agony. A shadow blotted out the light. Henry Bowers was standing over him, swaying back and forth. His knees buckled, his left hand was dripping blood on the front of Eddie's robe. Eddie had held onto the stump of the Perrier bottle, and now, as Henry's knees came completely unhinged, he got it in front of him, jagged base pointing upward, the cap braced against his sternum. Henry came down like a tree, impaling himself on the bottle. Eddie felt it shatter in his hand, and a fresh bolt of grinding agony shuddered through his left arm, which was still trapped under his body. Fresh warmth cascaded over him. He wasn't sure if this batch was Henry's blood or his. Henry twitched like a landed trout. His shoes rattled an almost syncopated beat on the carpet. Eddie could smell his rotten breath. Then Henry stiffened and rolled over. The bottle protruded grotesquely from his midsection, capped end pointing toward the ceiling as if it had grown there.
"Gug,"
Henry said, and said no more. He looked up at the ceiling. Eddie thought he might be dead. Eddie fought off the waves of faintness that wanted to cover him over and drag him down. He got to his knees and finally to his feet. There was fresh pain as his broken arm swung out in front of him, and that cleared his head a little. Wheezing, fighting for breath, he made it to the night table. He picked his aspirator out of a puddle of carbonated water, stuck it in his mouth, and triggered it off. He shuddered at the taste, then gave himself another blast. He looked around at the body on the carpet.
Could that be Henry?
Could it possibly be?
It was. Grown old, his crew cut more gray than black, his body now fat and white and slug-like, it was still Henry. And Henry was dead. At long last, Henry was...
Gug,
Henry said, and sat up. His hands clawed at the air, as if for holes which only Henry could see. His gouged eye leaked and dribbled, its bottom arc now bulged pregnantly down onto his cheek. He looked around, saw Eddie shrinking back against the wall, and tried to get up. He opened his mouth and a stream of blood gushed out. Henry collapsed again. Heart racing, Eddie fumbled for the telephone and succeeded only in knocking it off the table and onto the bed. He snatched it up and dialed O. The phone rang again and again and again.
Come on, Eddie thought. What are you doing down there, jacking off? Come on, please answer the frigging phone.
It rang again and again. Eddie kept his eyes on Henry, expecting him to start trying to gain his feet again at any moment.
Blood. Dear God, so much blood.
Desk, a fuzzy, resentful voice said at last.
Ring Mr. Denbrough's room, Eddie said, quick as you can.
With his other ear, he was now listening to the rooms around him.
How loud had they been?
Was someone going to pound on the door and ask if everything was all right in there?
You sure you want me to ring? The clerk asked.
It's 3:10.
Yes, do it,
Eddie nearly screamed. The hand holding the phone was trembling in convulsive little bursts. There was a nest of waspy, rotten, ugly singing in his other arm.
Had Henry moved again?
No, surely not. Okay, the clerk said. Cool your jets, my friend. There was a click, and then the hoarse burr of a room phone ringing.
Come on, Bill, come on.
A sudden thought, gruesomely plausible, occurred to him. Suppose Henry had visited Bill's room first?
Or Richie's, Ben's, Bev's.
Or had Henry perhaps paid a visit to the library? Surely he had been somewhere else first. If someone hadn't softened Henry up, it would have been Eddie lying dead on the floor, with a switchblade growing out of his chest the way the neck of the Perrier bottle was growing out of Henry's gut. Or suppose Henry had visited all the others first, catching them bleary and half asleep, as Henry had caught him.
Suppose they were all dead.
And that thought was so awful, Eddie believed he would soon begin screaming if someone didn't answer the phone in Bill's room.
Please, Big Bill, Eddie whispered. Please be there, man.
The phone was picked up, and Bill's voice, uncharacteristically cautious, said,
Hello? Bill,
Eddie said, almost babbled.
Bill, thank God.
Eddie?
Bill's voice grew momentarily fainter, speaking to someone else, telling the someone who it was. Then he was back strong.
Well, what's the matter, Eddie? It's Henry Bowers,
Eddie said. He looked at the body on the floor again.
Had it changed position?
This time it was not so easy to persuade himself it hadn't.
Bill, he came here, and I killed him. He had a knife.
He lowered his voice.
I think it was the same knife he had that day, when we went into the sewers. Do you remember?
I remember, Bill said grimly. Eddie, listen to me. I want you to... 12. The Barons, 1:55 p.m.
Go back and tell Ben to come up here.
Okay,
Eddie said, and dropped back at once. They were approaching the clearing now. Thunder rumbled in the overcast sky, and the bushes sighed in the rising breeze. Ben joined him as they came into the clearing. The trap door to the clubhouse stood open, an improbable square of blackness in the green. The sound of the river was very clear, and Bill was suddenly struck by a crazy certainty that he was experiencing that sound, and this place, for the last time in his childhood. He drew a deep breath, smelling earth and air and the distant sooty dump, fuming like a sullen volcano that cannot quite make up its mind to erupt. He saw a flock of birds fly off the railroad trestle and toward the old cape. He looked up at the boiling clouds.
What is it?
Ben asked.
Why haven't they tried to get us?
Bill asked.
They're there. Eddie was right about that. I can heal them.
Yeah,
Ben said.
I guess they might be stupid enough to think we're going back into the clubhouse. Then they'd have us trapped.
Maybe,
Bill said. And then he felt a sudden, helpless fury at his stutter, which made it impossible for him to talk fast. Perhaps they were things he would have found impossible to say anyway. How he felt he could almost see through Henry Bowers's eyes. How he felt that, although on opposite sides, pawns controlled by opposing forces, he and Henry had grown very close. Henry expected them to stand and fight.
It
expected them to stand and fight.
and be killed. A chilly explosion of white light seemed to fill his head. They would be victims of the killer that had been stalking Derry ever since George's death. All seven of them. Perhaps their bodies would be found, perhaps not. It all depended on whether or not it could or would protect Henry, and to a lesser degree, Belch and Victor. Yes, to the outside, to the rest of this town, will have been victims of the killer. And that's right. In a funny sort of way, that really is right. It wants us dead. Henry's the tool to get it done, so it doesn't have to come out. Me first, I think. Beverly and Richie might be able to hold the others, or Mike. But Stan's scared, and so's Ben. Although I think he's stronger than Stan. And Eddie's got a broken arm. Why did I leave them down here? Christ, why did I? Bill? Ben said anxiously. The others joined them beside the clubhouse. Thunder whacked again, and the bushes began to rustle more urgently. The bamboo rattled on in the fading, stormy light. Bill. It was Richie now. Shh. The others fell uneasily silent under his blazing, haunted eyes.